we kind of looked around and said, hey, wait a sec, there's a whole subset of people that kind of grew up playing golf that are maybe younger and talk about things that, you know, at times it's a bit more irreverent than what we see on TV and a lot more authentic. And we looked around and said, let's go for it. Let's like make something. Let's do it. Let's like, we laugh at each other's jokes. We think it's funny. Like, let's put it out in the world and see what happens.
That was Chris Solomon, co-founder of the podcast, No Laying Up. Chris is our guest for episode 9 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview.
Everybody, I am so excited to bring the next guest to Innovate Jax. He comes from a totally different field in Jacksonville, but one I know our audience is going to want to know so much more about. Mr. Chris Solomon, welcome.
You're in my house. Welcome to my house, I should say.
For real. So here we are, and our audience, if they don't know you already, they're going to find out why I'm recording you at your house really soon. You are the co-founder of No Laying Up. Really interesting name that I know a lot of people know, but not everyone does. So let's start right there. Tell us about your company.
You want the name or what we actually do?
Well,
because the name is a very short story. I don't remember how we came up with it.
There's got to be a connection.
Yeah, it was just kind of, so we do golf content is the best way to describe it. And we like to celebrate the playing style and lifestyle of the guys that go for it. So if you're not familiar with golf, laying up in golf is inherently saying, kind of conceding that you can't execute something, can't pull off a shot, so you take a very safe route to the hole and how you would get there. So if you have water you need to clear and you're not sure if you can get it, or if you want to play conservatively, you would lay up on it. So we say, no laying up. Later, we didn't realize it at the time, but we were making a life motto for ourselves that when it came time to stop doing this as just a hobby and to make it a full-time job, it was kind of like, I think we kind of made our bed here and we got to sleep in it because we came up with the name No Laying Up. I think we have to go for this, which is a long way of saying it, but we do a golf podcast is probably what we're best known for. When we started that, we had no idea there was going to be as big of a boom in podcasts as there has been. And since then, we've grown quite a bit and brought in, I'm sure we'll get there, but part of the reason why we're in Jacksonville is the gentleman we brought in, DJ Pihowski, has helped us grow our video content leg of the business, and this is what we do full-time now. So we talk about golf, travel, videotape it, and somehow that has equated to a job that I have difficulty explaining to a lot of people, but I promise it is a full-time job.
I guarantee you got a lot of jealous people out there.
A lot of jealous people, and I am absolutely thrilled and love what I do and wouldn't trade it for a thing. However, we do also get a lot of, oh, so you just go around and play golf and film it. That's all you do, huh? That's a pretty cool job. I'm like, yeah, that's the fun part of the job. There's also the work part of it, the business side of it, and the risk side of it, which, you know, stays hidden for the most part. But that's also part of what, you know, the job is supposed to be enviable. This is supposed to be what people, you know, do in their leisure, is take in our content and watch our videos and get inspired to go travel and learn things about golf. So kind of promoting the fun element of the lifestyle is way more important to the authenticity of it than boring people with all the details of running a small business.
Well, you know, Chris, I think everybody, you know, in our audience, they're really interested in backstory. I know I'm interested in backstory, and I know your co-founder, you've got other members on your team that help put this, you know, amazing production together. Maybe let's start with you. You know, you're not originally from Jacksonville, are you?
No, I'm not. I grew up in Dublin, Ohio, just outside of Columbus. I went to Miami University in Ohio. A lot of people say, you know, Miami, we like to say at least, Miami was a school before Florida was even a state. So, well, the people that tout the University of Miami is the real Miami, we have a little bit of an issue with that one. So, a little chip on our shoulder, if you may. But at Miami University, I met two people that would end up being the co-founders of No Laying Up with me, a gentleman by the name of Todd Schuster and Phil Landis, who go by Tron Carter and Big Randy on our website. I don't know how long this podcast is, but I don't think I have time to explain either of the reasoning behind that. But it kind of goes along with the randomness of what this thing was in the beginning and what it's become, is that we didn't put a lot of thought into what our pin names would be. But then we started this in 2013, I guess, to jump ahead after college. They were just good friends of mine that we had you know, had a ton of sports conversations with over the years. It would be college football betting, NBA betting, NFL betting. It all kind of circled around gambling. But we kind of saw all those sports take off in terms of the alternative media landscape around them, right? Blogs around baseball, around football, and all these things got popped up. And the way the golf world works, everything is just usually a few years behind everything. I mean, I could go into a lot of details on that, but there wasn't really anything out there that we felt, at least that we were aware of, that talked about golf the way we talked about golf to each other. It was all very sterile and very, you know, I mean, when you think about tuning into a golf broadcast, it's associated with, you know, Viagra commercials and the older audience that it appeals to. And we kind of looked around and said, hey, wait a sec, there's a whole subset of people that kind of grew up playing golf that are maybe younger and talk about things that, you know, at times it's a bit more irreverent than what we see on TV and a lot more authentic. And we looked around and said, let's go for it. Let's like make something. Let's do it. Let's like, we laugh at each other's jokes. We think it's funny. Like, let's put it out in the world and see what happens. And it was very, very slow growth in the beginning. And
well, can I ask you first, you know, what was your background? How did know, you know, did you with a whole media strategy and you knew, you know, what you had this sense, but, you know, did you have the tools? Did you have the background? Did you bring consultants? What did
nothing,
you do?
Nothing at all. That's, you know, if we would have set out to make this business, I think we would have failed. I think we kind of fell into it because it was very real and it came from a place of just passion for the sport. I mean, we love golf. And my background was in accounting. I studied accounting at Miami University. I got a job with a Big Four firm right out of school, and that's what I did with my full time. I mean, I lived in Chicago. I audited financial services companies, and through that, I ended up actually getting an opportunity to do a secondment abroad in Amsterdam with my company. I had a Dutch client there and worked on that engagement, and they needed somebody to fill in my role in Amsterdam. And this is right around the time that we're starting this no laying up thing as a pure hobby on the side. I was actually, funny story, I was actually kind of embarrassed to tell people that like I had a golf blog. I mean, it just sounded so lame, and it probably was really lame, but at some point it flipped the script into actually being kind of cool and an enviable thing to do. But we all had full-time jobs. I mean, Todd worked in hotel and revenue management for Marriott. Phil was doing a variety of jobs, but ended up being a high school basketball coach and a teacher. We brought in Todd's brother, Neil, to help us with a lot of the technological aspects in the very early beginning. He worked for Google, and it was just we were all doing this on the side. Whenever we could get to it, we would, you know, have conference calls. Sometimes they were at midnight for me when I was living in Amsterdam, and the hours were difficult, and Neil lived in San Francisco, so he was 9 hours behind. The other guys were in the East Coast, and Todd was in Boston, and Phil was in Columbus, and it was not set up to succeed, but it was somehow. I don't know how. It was just, like I said, we were just kind of winging it, and it somehow just worked. And the only background I really had was I was just a massive sports fan, and I had you know, consumed enough content of and related to sports over the years that I kind of knew what I liked, knew what I didn't want to be. And I guess I look back and I don't think I set out saying I know what people would like, but I think I in some way kind of knew it inherently. It just needed to be different. I knew that from the very beginning. It was like, if our stuff looks like other people's stuff, this thing is not going to work. And that's kind of what the genesis of it all was.
Well, Chris, I think you kind of nailed two things that as far as being an entrepreneur and what's going to make someone successful, it's got to start from a place of passion, which you clearly had. But you also identified a problem that needed to be solved, right? You know, you wanted the sports story, the golf story, to be told in a different way.
There was a gap there. Exactly.
A big gap. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it wasn't just like a fluffy assumption. I mean, this really did come from a real opportunity. And I think, too, you had already identified that the other sports, you know, hockey probably had, you know, its ardent, crazy fans that were able to blog and produce, you know, their own commentary. But, you know, you pivoted closer to the consumer. And so you were the perfect subset of what that consumer was. So I think, you know, do you agree? You know, did that really help with, you know, getting yourselves successful? And, you know, let's talk about the couple years that you you decided that you were going to go ahead and produce this content.
Well, again, this was a big learning process for us. So this whole thing didn't start with a big whiteboard of here's the model, here's what we're going to do, and we're going to knock people's socks off, and people are just going to love it. It just was an ever-evolving thing, and we're still evolving. And one thing we kind of learned, or not really learned, I guess figured out, is the advantage that golf has over other sports is not only is there the whole professional game that we can talk about, and we do talk about on the podcast, we interact with professional golfers, and people love hearing those stories, but people also play golf way late into their lives. I mean, how people go on golf trips, every destination is different. Every climate is different. The style of play in the UK is different than Australia, which is different than the West Coast, which is different than Florida, which is different than Texas, which is different than North Carolina, on and on and on and on and on. And the fact that, you know, if people don't take a basketball trip. People don't go to Australia and play basketball. The court is the same, the height, you know, the lines are a little bit different in international basketball, but the hoops are the same height, and you just would never do that. But golf has this destination advantage, right? You could spend a lifetime covering golf courses and golf stories and not even come close to scratching the surface. That's one huge advantage that we had working for us. Two is professional golfers are a lot more relatable to people from an athletic standpoint than, say, a defensive lineman or a 7 foot tall basketball player. From an athlete, you can sit next to a professional golfer on a flight and ask, you know, talk to them about pro golf and not know that they're a pro golfer. If you see a defensive lineman get on your plane, you're like, oh, I wonder what sport that guy plays. And so, you know, the golfers weren't necessarily being covered in a way that was, I don't think, best for them, right? So they go do press conferences and media, right? They sit up there and, you know, there's a lot of writing that has happened in golf for many, many, many years. We tried, and that was one of the things that we looked at and said, well, look, let's not compete with people on writing. There's people that are better at writing than us. I don't want to go head-to-head with the top writers of Golf Digest and Golf.com and ESPN. Let's do things different. So when they go to write something, they go to a press conference and they have an idea of what they want to write and they ask the player a question, right? And players have gotten bitten enough by giving very candid answers in press conferences that they know something they say up there might be a headline, right? If I say, you know, yeah, I think I'm a better player than Rory McIlroy, boom, headline, Sports Illustrated, next day, done. If they come on and give a 4-minute answer as to why they like the way their career stacks up against Rory McIlroy's in the context of a podcast, a whole conversation, people can listen directly to what they said and understand the you know, if they said something with laughter, it's a joke, blah, blah, blah. And that's what we started doing with players. We had them on the podcast and said, for sometimes an hour, they would sit down and say, hey, talk to me about your career. Tell the story of this. Like, give me the context of this story. And players really, really started to like that. They saw the feedback and the feedback they got from people overwhelmingly was, hey, I feel like I know this person way better than I did to start. And sometimes it's, man, I never liked Rory McIlroy, but it's hard not to root for him after listening to him on the podcast. So it was kind of hard to get that initial wave of guys to come on and say, hey, spend an hour with these no-name guys that, and like 1,000 people are going to listen to this. Like, why would you do it? To now, players will come to us and say, I'd love to come on, now that hundreds of thousands of people listen to every episode.
Right.
And they see the impact that some of these interviews have had. It's a lot easier to get people to come on and tell their story. And it's just this whole medium that we, again, didn't set out to say, podcasting is the future. That's where we're going to make the difference. It just kind of fell in our lap. And we dedicated time to it. There's some luck involved, but it is a lot of work that went to it. And I've worked really hard to try to become a better interviewer and do research and understand what people want out of it. But yeah, that was kind of where our biggest competitive advantage came from. I don't even remember what the original question is. Well, I could talk a lot, as you could see.
No, really, really. So a couple questions for you. So first of all, I want to know how you did get access in the early days when you were just nothing more than a super fan. But didn't No Laying Up actually start not as a podcast?
Yeah, it was a Twitter account. That's where it started. Yeah.
So talk about totally changing the game for, you know, the sport that's going to have your Viagra commercials. you're talking about golf on a medium that it really is generationally much more accessible, and you're looking to produce content that, you know, not everyone wants to read a 5-page article.
Right.
You know, you're going after, again, a market that, you know, you really kind of, I think you tapped into something. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you clearly were successful there. But tell us about that Twitter account first and foremost.
Well, for a diehard golf fan, sitting and watching a golf broadcast, I mean, we're talking, I have to be in the top 1% of golf fans in the world, correct? I mean, I think that's a safe assumption. I struggle to sit and watch an entire broadcast. I don't think it's exciting. I think they don't do a great job of telling some of these stories, of presenting it in an exciting way. So, like, I find myself just mindlessly scrolling my phone. And I would scroll Twitter and like look for someone that would talk about what I'm watching on TV, and it didn't really exist. Like the presence there now is insane. There's so many people that do running commentary and jokes and stuff, and we just said, like, why can't we be one of those people?
Yeah.
let's start leading the conversation. And we, you know, threw stuff out there. We had no strategy. We made inappropriate jokes. We joked about, we made our own inside jokes and threw them out in the world as if people would laugh about them. And it took time, but people started to kind of catch on to these inside jokes and, you know, something that we would reference when they would see it happen on TV.
So
like,
let me pause there for a second. Sure. So did Goff even, you know, if Goff didn't care, you know, the traditional channels weren't on social media and, you know, doing the play-by-play, how did you even make your conversations discoverable? Were there hashtags?
No, for the that's the thing. We didn't know. Like, we were making all these funny jokes. At least we thought they were funny.
Yeah.
And no, it would get like one like or one retweet. And if we got to 10, we'd be texting each other like, holy crap, this one is really taking off. And looking back, we had no strategy. And then we started to learn a little bit of like, hey, you need to like talk at people. You need to be involved in discussions. You need to, and it is a very circular thing. And I look back at all of, you know, the things that have brought us to where we are. And like, I think I'm maybe most proud of gaining like the first 1,000 followers on social media.
Hard
like
one.
The first 1,000.
Very hard one.
Is so, so challenging. The second 1,000 is not that hard. It starts to be kind of a circular thing, especially the way Twitter works. Is, you know, if people are sharing your stuff, it gets in front of more eyeballs. It doesn't really work that way necessarily on Instagram as much as Twitter is just very circular. So once we started powering through, you know, 2,000, 3,000, then it started to be kind of become addicting. Then I started to kind of track the growth and see like, hey, during major tournaments, we're gaining this many people a day and blah, blah, blah. And it was, again, without ever setting aside time to be like, hey, let's measure this. It was inherent. I said, all right, let's figure out where this growth is coming from. What are our most popular topics to talk about? And everyone else in golf, I felt like had just terrible social media strategies. It was just meeting the bare minimum. I mean, the PGA Tour wasn't even like tracking the events very closely on social media at the time. And the guy that was doing it for them was a one-man crew who now lives down the street from me and works for us.
Oh,
and
how about that?
That team is now like over 30 people that runs it, but they were very late in the game. And like I said earlier, just took golf. It takes golf time to learn, you know, where to invest time and what the advantages, the competitive advantages you should have are. So we were just gaining this presence on Twitter, on social media, because we were saying things that CBS can't say, NBC can't say, Golf Channel can't say. I mean, they can't make fun of the players. They can't tease the players. They are in charge of broadcasting, right? And I'm not saying they should be doing that, but we had that advantage. We had nothing to lose, and we could say funny things, and we could make people angry, and we did it, and we just threw it out there. We had absolutely nothing to lose. And it started to gain a following bigger and bigger. And then players started following us, and players started showing other players tweets in the locker room. Like, hey, did you see this? They said this and blah, blah, blah. And we learned pretty quickly who the guys were that could take a joke and who the guys were that couldn't take a joke.
Right.
And it just grew. And we had some young players, you know, specifically Justin Thomas was the first player we ever had on the podcast. And at the time he was a rookie. He followed us coming straight out of college. And during his time, like on the web.com tour, and you know, he was not, right now he's one of the top 5 players in the world, but we got in with him when he was a rookie and he was a star and people knew he was going to be a good player. He was the first full interview we ever did, and I was just giddy. I couldn't believe it. I like, holy crap, we're going to talk to a pro golfer and record it and we're going to share it with the world. Like, I could be wrong, but I don't think that really, definitely not at the scale that it does now, but it didn't really exist in the golf world at the time. And that's where we just kind of started to get our competitive advantage. Guys wanted to come on, share stories, and have real conversations, right? It's not, you know, when you see an interview after a round, it's like, what was your mindset going into Sunday?
Right,
it's like, no, dude, hey, tell me about traveling around Latin America for a while and tell me a story. And it's a lot more real and it's relatable because we are not peers in professional standpoint, but we're around the same age. Like, we talk the same language, and I'm not, you know, a TV interviewer. I'm asking you questions that, you know, as a golf fan, if I ever got to meet you, that's what I would want answered. And again, that wasn't necessarily the strategy, but that's just how it worked. That's just how we did it. And it just kind of grew from there and grew and grew. Yeah.
All right. So Chris, how did you start to monetize? How did you, you know, there must have been a time that you're like, you have sponsors started knocking on your door. So when did that happen?
I'll tell you, it's a very specific time that happened. And this was, so I was living abroad in Amsterdam as this was really taking off. And it was just a weird, weird existence for me because it only existed online. Okay. I had never had a chance to interact with players personally. I had never had a chance to meet players personally. And I didn't understand, to be honest, like the impact it was having. I didn't understand that like everyone, not everyone, but like almost everyone on the tour knew who we were and was aware of it in some way, either for better or for worse. I mean, sometimes we say dumb things and people think we're idiots. I'm not saying that's inaccurate at all, but one guy that followed us was Roy McIlroy, who is four-time major champion, one of, at minimum, the two best players in the world currently, maybe the best player of the last decade. And he's around, he's two or three years younger than me. And just he was following us a lot closer than I had realized. He was listening to the podcast, which, you know, at the time there was maybe 2,000, 3,000 people listening to it, but he was one of them. And I didn't know that. And when I went to the Ryder Cup in the fall of 2016, he somehow knew who I was and what I looked like, which I never put my...
I was going to say, did you have press credentials?
I had press credentials, yeah. And I got to walk inside the ropes. Okay. It was the coolest experience of my life. And during the Ryder Cup, during his matches, he's talking to me and making jokes and referencing things that I had said on Twitter and making fun of me for them. And like, in particular, there was a pairing that I wanted the U.S. team to have, and it was Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka. And I just wanted them to get paired together. And he was playing against them. They finally paired them, and he's playing against them. And he's beating them by three. And on the ninth tee box, he looks at me and he says, "Hey, you got your wish." He was taunting me in the middle of the Ryder Cup match, which I'm an accountant in Amsterdam on the other side of the world while this is happening. And this happens in rural Minnesota, in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
It must have been an out-of-body experience.
It was unbelievable. Yeah. When I went back after that, and I just thought, man, like, whoa, this thing is way different than what I understood it to be. And so I messaged him on Twitter. You know, we had exchanged some DMs in the past, but messaged him and said, "Hey, if you ever want to come like do the podcast, let me know." And he didn't reply for like 3 weeks. I was like, okay, I creeped him out. That's weird. He replied 3 weeks later. He's like, "Hey, sorry, I've been off social media. Here's my number. Text me anytime you want." And he starts like feeding me inside information and all this. And he withdrew from a tournament in Turkey and that he was getting ready to play. So I knew he had this week. Like, these guys schedule out their years way in advance. And he withdrew at the last minute for security reasons. So I know he's got this week. I'm like, "Hey, I don't think you got much going on." So I shot him a message, said, "Hey, I know you mentioned you maybe want to come on the podcast sometime. Like, let me know if this week works." He goes, "Hey, how's tomorrow?" And I had to come up with a reason to miss work. And we had a phone call at 11 a.m. the next morning. And we just covered everything about his career. And when I posted that, I knew that things were different. I knew that things had changed, right? And a couple months later, he, you know, is going through our Twitter mentions. And I mentioned to somebody, I said, "No new podcast this week. Our guest just canceled," which was another player. And he had canceled. And he messages me and says, "Hey, I saw your guest canceled. You want to do another one?" It was his idea. And on that podcast, he said, "You know, I followed you guys for a while, and I think what you're doing is very important to the future of golf media, and anything I can do to support it, I'm in." And while this is happening, I literally am like, "You know what? I don't think my future is in accounting anymore."
Yeah.
I was like, "We have something here that's crazy." And less than a month later, we got the first, you know, interest from a sponsor, and it was Callaway, one of the biggest equipment manufacturers in the world. And it's so funny to look back at that conversation, right? So they're like, "Hey, we want to sponsor the podcast, you know, blah, blah, blah. Let us know how much you guys would, what it would cost to sponsor it for the rest of the year." And we are throwing around numbers within our little group chat. Like, what do we ask for? Like, is it crazy if we ask for blah, 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 this amount? And we settled on an amount four times that. We were like, let's shoot for the moon. Let's go for a crazy amount of money, which you'll see very shortly, it was not a crazy amount of money. So I texted him, I was like, "Hey," it's literally by WhatsApp, "Hey, we love, you know, if you guys sponsor the rest of the year at this price." Within 30 minutes, the deal was done. They're like, "Yep, okay, that's fine." And we were like, "Oh my God, this is an incredible amount." I'll tell it's
Was this the day that you all quit your jobs?
No, we'll get to that part.
Okay.
This was a five-figure amount of money.
Okay.
So this is not insane. But to us, we had shot for the moon.
Yeah.
We had no idea what kind of money there was in golf or how much a sponsorship, what our podcast was worth. So going back to, you asked if I had media experience, I had nothing, nothing to work off of. So the amount, I'll say the amount. That's fine. It was $40,000.
Yeah.
And I quit my job over $40,000. And I'd say, for the whole company, there's four of us at the time. And I was like, "Yep, you know what? Like, that's enough."
Proof of concept. Got it.
Proof of concept. Yep. And I, based on that, so my secondment in Amsterdam was coming to an end within the next couple months. And I knew I was going to have to go back to my job in Chicago. And I just started to ask myself, I said, "Do I want to do this full time? Do I want this to be my career?" And the answer to that was yes. I should have, you know, from a mathematical and financial standpoint, gone and worked for another year and then quit my job. I was supposed to contractually. I had to pay a fee to break my contract with the company. And I probably should have. But I said, you know, where is the company going to be July 1, 2018. So if I stayed one more year, I would have started July 1, 2018 full-time. If I quit now, July 1, 2017, and spend a year dedicating myself to finding more sponsors, continuing the content, keep going with the momentum, are we going to be in a better spot July 1, 2018 if I quit now or if I quit a year later? And the answer is very clearly quit now. Like, right. Let's go. Is it too early? Probably. I moved in with my parents. I lived with my parents in Columbus, Ohio for 5 months. And during that time, made my first visit to Jacksonville, where like one of my partners had already moved down here, and the other one, which we were soon to hire, had been living here for several years. And after spending 5 months living at home, which was, I'd say, about 4 months too many. I mean, it was lovely to have my laundry folded and on my bed, but I was 31 years old.
Was it the little twin bed that you had?
Was a full size bed, I believe. It was nice to sleep in a very comfortable childhood bed. but like I said, about 4 months too many. It was lovely, but I had no reason to be in Ohio or anywhere else. So I said, let's give Jacksonville a try. I got two guys that already live down there. We rented this house that we're in right now called the Kill House, and that's a long story, kind of a short story, but because I said, well, if we're going to need somewhere to work, and two of the four of us were already located down here, so why not make it, two of the five of us at the time were already located here, why not come down here? Let's figure it out and let's go for it.
All right, so Chris, let's talk about it. Yeah. What brought them to Jacksonville? I obviously you were following them, but what brought them here?
Yeah, so it all kind of stems back to the Players Championship, which is held here now every March. It was in May at the time, but DJ Pihowski, who I mentioned, is joined our team in this summer of 2017, had lived here for several years because he worked for the PGA Tour. And the PGA Tour is located here in Ponte Vedra, which is about 20 minutes from where we're recording this now, in Neptune Beach. And so he was located here, but he had been a lot of different roles within the PGA Tour and was ready to make a move to something a bit where you have a bit more creative freedom. The PGA Tour world is just a very corporate world, and DJ is an incredibly creative, artistic, and hilarious guy. And we had an opportunity. He came to us and said, "You guys have something good here, but I can just tell that you guys have no idea what you're doing," which was very accurate. And he said such in not such uncertain terms, and presented to us like, "Hey, here's what I can help you with. Like, this sounds crazy, but you need like a brand strategy. Like, if you're gonna do this, like what is it you guys do?" And we had no answer for that. We just didn't, and we needed like a mission statement. And when you're doing dumb jokes on Twitter, you don't think of like a mission statement, but once we made that, it made it very easy for us to look up and say, like, "Hey, is what I'm doing currently accomplishing that mission statement?" And it was pretty easy to weed out the things that we shouldn't be spending our time on and the things we should be spending our time on. And that mission statement
was... what is it?
It's to use our access to inform and entertain our audience. If you can do both of those things, I should say inform or entertain. And if you can do both of them, that's the best. So Right. Some of it's supposed to be funny. Some of it's actually like hard hitting and very serious. But, we have been put in an incredible position that we can tell some stories in golf. And if we abuse that access and are very self-serving with it, we are not doing the right thing for our audience, right? We are kind of letting our audience down. A lot of people would kill to be in the positions that we are. But we got to use that to make sure we, entertain and inform them. And I said this to our group the other day. I said, I look back at like our podcast and I think like, man, I've learned a lot in this, and I've literally shared everything I've learned, right? So I've passed on everything that has come through. Sometimes people say things to you in confidence and you can't share it, but man, I feel pretty proud of what we've built and that like all the things, all the conversations we've had, we've recorded them and we've shared them and put them out there to people. So fans, I think, come to us to feel closer to the game and to professional players and to, stories from us traveling the world and things like that.
So, Chris, you obviously have your roots in social media. Is that how you're keeping a pulse on what your audience wants to know? I mean, do you take questions from them? Do you get, requests for next guests? How is it that you're sure that you're really feeding back what they're looking to receive?
For better or for worse, I do read a lot of the feedback that we receive on social media. We have a message board, too. It's called The Refuge, where we kind of view that as our premium members, and that like the people that are most passionate, most involved, and giving us the most feedback on so many things. And yeah, you can see pretty easily through social media what's working and what's not, what people really get excited about, are passionate about. And yeah, that's kind of the filter, I guess, it comes through. There's a lot of riffraff out there on social media, a lot of stuff you need to filter through that's like, "Hey man, like this you know, people give us negative feedback.
Trolls live.
I want to just say, like, hey, like maybe this isn't for you, man. Like, there's a lot of people that are interested in it. If you hate it, to be honest, I don't judge you for it. Like, I don't know if I would, you know, be as passionate about what we do if I was on the outside of, you know, passionate about our content if I was on the outside of it. But there are a lot of people that are. And so our goal is every day that we wake up, it's like to deliver to those people. And if we're doing that, we can't be obsessed. You can't be obsessed with trying to reach a fan, like the next fan, right? We have an audience and it's grown organically because we serve that audience day in and day out. Honestly, we are not in the business of growing the audience. If it grows organically, that's great. And there's a lot of people that measure the success of their business based on the growth. We've gotten to the point where I think we're big enough that if we just continue to serve that audience, I don't want to say it can't fail, but it's unlikely to fail. Mm-hmm. If we try to do different things and try to be all things to all people to grow the audience, then are we serving the audience that we already have? Are we being loyal to that fan base? I don't think we are. So if you want in to on the inside jokes, like it's almost kind of like it's hard to be kind of half into our content. You might pick up a podcast episode and be like, what are these guys talking about? Like, this makes no sense.
It's like picking up something mid-season. It's like, what?
Exactly. Yeah, but if you've listened to 250 of them, you're like, oh, God, I knew that was coming. Yeah, I could totally see that.
All right, Chris, so you're kind of like this accidental entrepreneur, right? You backed into this job. You backed into, you know, what you thought was going to be a hobby and landing, you know, proof of concept from Rory McIlroy. I mean, that never happens. So congratulations there. But let's talk about, you know, you kind of had to grow up, right? You found someone who said you guys need a brand strategy. Let's talk about how you arrived at a business model. You obviously have a business background. You have associates that have business backgrounds. When you really decided, okay, we're going for it, how did you decide what that business model was going to be? And what is it for No Laying Up?
So I get that question a lot. It's like, hey, again, you guys are traveling the world. You're doing this. How do you make money? How do you do this? And we're very fortunate enough that our audience is very sizable. And not only is it sizable, they are very highly engaged. And we are so fortunate to have found some partners in, you know, both the golf landscape and outside the golf landscape that understand audience engagement. And that doesn't mean impressions. And a lot of people, I think, like going back to kind of touching on a lot of the things we've talked about here, is can be very obsessed with this impression number. But we've always said, like, not all impressions are created equal. And that, you know, we were kind of looking around at other golf media legacy brands and kind of seeing the engagement that they would get on social media on a per follower basis compared to ours. And some of the legacy brands, we were getting maybe 100x their engagement.
Wow.
Which is pretty powerful when you put that on a slide and take it to a sponsor. But what you need is a sponsor that understands that, right? Because some, you know, if you have a very complicated ad business structure, right? If you have an ad agency that works for you, that is buying up spots for you, and you don't really care to get engaged and understand that, you just care about the numbers that are going to go on some PowerPoint, you can end up with a sponsor strategy that looks like a lot of the other forgettable strategies out there. If you ask some of the legacy, you know, last people in the street, some of the legacy brands that are associated, I guess some of the partners that are associated with some of the legacy brands, they probably couldn't name them. But if you're familiar with us, you know exactly who our partners are. We're very upfront about it, and we have few of them. And our goal was to, you know, find the big key partners that are going to understand the value in having their brand associated with ours. And so, again, I talked a lot about serving our audience and how dedicated we are to that. But it's also, you're representing these companies, right?
100%, so right.
That doesn't mean we can't say what we want to say. You just have to be careful. You can't be reckless. You can't be, you know, foolish with things because, like I said, you are representing a lot of other interested parties. And so we've been so fortunate. Callaway Golf was our first big one. Next up was BMW. Again, a very random one, but they invited us out to their event, the BMW Championship. And said, hey, you know, one of their guys was a follower of ours. I'm familiar with your guys' content. We'd love for you to come out, do some podcasts, and, you know, do a video on playing in the Pro-Am, which I'd never played in Pro-Am before. Like, I'm going to go up, tee it up with, you know, like one of the top, it's only the top 70 in the FedEx Cup standings, make that tournament. I'm going to play with, I ended up playing with John Rahm, and we made a video about it.
Were you mic'd up? This was like a whole, not like, you not up, only had to, okay, I was going to say, you had to golf and record this video.
So
and
DJ, this is our first big video project
good
we
Lord.
Did. DJ came, followed our group around and filmed basically the whole thing and made this video. And it just blew up on social media. It went, like, you know, hundreds of retweets, over 100,000 views in just a couple days. And BMW was thrilled with that. I mean, it was like a just they're, you know, they've invested in golf. So in engaging us to help grow their investment in the tournament that they sponsor, it's a no-brainer. I mean, the dollar amount that comes with sponsoring a PGA Tour event versus the dollar amount it takes to get us on site,
right?
Not even in the same
stratosphere.
Not even the same currency, basically.
Right.
So spending a little bit on us to help, you know, activate all the money you're spending here is kind of our model, right? So that became our model. So they were so thrilled with how that went, they wanted to extend into a whole deal for the next year and the next year. And our mindset has never been for, you know, quick money grabs. It's, you know, our partnership with you in year one, it might be modest, but we are going to deliver on that. Like, I promise you. And we are, I don't want to say 100% retention rate, but near 100% retention of continuing our partnerships from year to year.
So you have your relationship building and you're amplifying an ROI, that much bigger bucket of money that they've invested in an event, by bringing your team on site.
Exactly.
And getting a lot more attention to their brand.
But at the same time, the most important part and the hardest part of all of that is maintaining the authenticity in the content, right?
Sure.
So we go to them and say, like, they honestly, and this is what makes our partners so great, they don't tell us what to do. They'll give us some ideas. They'll say, hey, we have this going on. What would you guys like to do? And that's the partners that we know we want to work with.
Right.
So,
right.
Like, they never did, they had no editing say in that video. They didn't say, like, hey, try this, try this. They said, we know what you guys do. Go do it here. We'd like to engage you to go do it. And that's the most important part, because people are smart. Our audience is very smart. And if they're being sold something,
yeah,
they're going to put up the wall up. Like, right. The barrier that you got to clear for, you know, sponsored content is bigger. So we are very, very picky about who we pick out as our sponsors. We 100%, I believe, we could make a lot more money than we do, because we could say yes to a lot more partnerships. But that's, we didn't set, maybe this is not best for the podcast or for business or whatever, but we didn't set out to do this to make a ton of money. We set out because it was a passion. We figured out a way to make it work from a financial standpoint. But honestly, the worst thing, if you doubled my salary and we, you know, people hated what we did, I wouldn't wake up fulfilled. I wouldn't enjoy it. That's not to say that we don't have great ideas and big ideas for growing the business in the future, but it is more for us more about, you know, I guess the main, go back to your question, the main driver of our revenue and where we can actually make some profit is off the partnerships. You know, they come with, you know, our podcast is very highly downloaded. So there's the real estate of advertising on a podcast is very, it's expensive. We didn't know that when we started that it was going to take off the way it has, but you know, it's a great business model for us. I mean, videos take way, way more time than a podcast does. And on top of all the, you know, kind of the partnerships, we have merchandise too. And our merchandise operation is multiplying every single year. And Neil and Todd have done such a great job growing that. I mean, you name some kind of clothing item or golf related item, we have it in some way, shape or form in the pro shop. And if it's in stock, because it's hard to keep things in stock. And
that
is
so fun.
A whole new business for us also, not only just media, but like, and I'm very detached from that part, that side of the business, because those guys do such a good job with it. But learning how to manage your inventory levels and your lead time and your shipping time and fulfillments and, hey, how do you ship from Utah to Ireland and all the things that go into that. And it's crazy. It's insane. And it's risky. I mean, if you order 50 small sweaters, and that's not a small check you're writing. And if you move 5 of those 50, like, you might wipe out all of your profits from 10 other items you sold. And
right.
So it's all very complicated, but it's all things we're learning, and we take very calculated steps in doing them.
Did you bring in some expertise in e-commerce to help you grow that side? Or know you mentioned your partners are managing it, but
just a growth and learning process.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all have skills that we've picked up from working in very different parts of business all around the world in the last, you know, 5 years. And maybe the most important skill is adaptability and adjusting and, like, not always thinking you know the right way. I mean, you have to learn, and we have made mistakes. Oh my goodness. I'm giving you the highlight tour of all the things that have gone right for us. We have made plenty of mistakes, but you know, this is, I feel like I'm about to say like a poster, a motivational post you would put out on the wall, but the biggest mistake would be to not learn from the mistakes. Right. And so, yeah, we've made mistakes with, you know, merchandise, and we've ordered too much of one thing, and we've not ordered enough of another thing, and we've said things we shouldn't, and all these things kind of add up to, you know, I guess, learning. It all comes down to learning.
All right. So, Chris, along this journey, you know, you have probably had, you know, obviously very, very highs and very, very lows. Give us a low light and then give us a highlight of where you are to date.
The low lights, we try not to highlight those too much because they're all out there. And
just to share for an audience that's new to you, you know, or who's trying to, you know, they're in the same struggle and they haven't broken through quite yet.
Yeah.
You know, let's hear how similar there might have a story to
you. So a low light for me personally was something, I wrote something two, three years ago that was just reckless. And it was kind of wading into the journalism area of golf. Kind of, I mentioned earlier, hey, we don't want to compete with people on writing and the real journalists. And I leaned too far into that. And I did not take good notes on what I was told. And I wrote it up, you know, kind of forgetting that things get, you know, that people are actually out there reading it. Because, you know, you know, if things are moving kind of slow, you kind of think, okay, I need to add some edge to it, add some excitement. And I overstepped. And I learned that day, like, hey, man, if you want to talk about things that happen, you got to have the details right. And you got to have sources. And the whole journalism model made way more sense to me after experiencing that. And the only way I was going to learn that was by making a mistake.
Right.
I'm glad it happened when it did. And I honestly can say I learned from it. And I have even more respect for journalists after that. And that was a low light. But again, I think we kind of turned that into a positive and understood that was going to happen at some point. And getting that out of the way has helped free me up a little bit. A highlight, it'd be really hard to pick one. The one I always go to is that interaction that I had with Rory McIlroy. But, you know, it wasn't our greatest interview ever. And it came with some strings attached, but around this time last year, we're recording this in November, Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson were getting ready to play what was called the match. They were playing a head-to-head match the day after Thanksgiving, and it was on pay-per-view, and you know, I'd formed some relationships with some people in the agency that represented Tiger Woods, and I knew what they were after. They wanted to help sell pay-per-view, but you know, subscriptions to the event, but we got a phone call that asked if we wanted to come and interview Tiger and Phil before the match. And I thought back to what I was doing like a year before that and, you know, accounting for a big four firm. And I thought like, wow, when it came time to like sell subscriptions, they turned to us. And again, it wasn't a no strings attached interview. It was 12 minutes, but the microphone you're talking into right now is the same one that Tiger Woods talked into. And it was a very surreal feeling to sit across the table from him, ask him weird questions. It was not a normal interview, but we like had burning questions on our mind of like, hey, you said you popped your wrist out of place at the Masters. Did that really happen? And kind of tease him, what was the most, you know, regrettable fashion choice you ever made? And hearing him talk about those things and hearing him laugh about it, that was a highlight moment.
Do you have to send questions in advance?
No. Nope,
they sit down cold.
I never do send questions in advance. I will send some topics from time to time, but rarely do people ask for them.
Really? I'm surprised that the agents aren't kind of vetting in advance.
No, I tell people before they sit down, I say, look, we're not going to play gotcha. We're not here to get you.
Yeah.
I don't give the players editorial control of them, but I say like, hey man, if I overstep on a question, like, and if you give a bad answer or something that you don't want in there, and if you want me to take it out, I'll be glad to take it out afterwards.
So it's safe. It's safe.
And that has happened two times in the history of the podcast. And it wasn't necessarily bad stuff. It was just like, hey man, I kind of messed up my answer to that. I'd prefer if that wasn't in there because they have a different interest in it, et cetera. And it's no problem. And that, I think, helps people open up even more. And they start to realize, like, hey, it's actually not that bad to talk about this topic. I don't have to watch every word I say because they have some editing possibilities in it. So
that must resonate so much with your audience. I mean, talk about the authenticity. I mean, you really are, you know, they're totally dropping their guard versus that other model that they're so used to that you were reacting to. Mm-hmm. So,
There's been every year, you know, I've tried to make a point. We make a highlight episode of the podcast where we take the best stories of the year and release it around Christmas. One, just because I like to take a little time off around Christmas, and that's easy to repurpose some of the content we've already made. But it's also like people can kind of forget the stories. You know, you hear it, and we do a lot of podcasts, and it'd be easy to forget some of the really funny moments or the really insightful moments through the year, and it's just good to get a reminder at the end.
So let's talk about grinding out a podcast as frequently as you do. What's your cadence for publishing?
During the meat of the season, we try to do an episode every Sunday night and every Tuesday night. So basically for your Monday morning commute and Wednesday morning commute. We typically see the most interaction and downloads and listenership on the Sunday Night Reaction podcast. So if, you know, during the, especially from like January up to the Masters, which is in mid-April, people are into golf. And, you know, not everyone lives here in Florida in beautiful, sunny Jacksonville like we do. And not everyone's playing golf in the winter. They're watching golf in the winter, and they are ready to interact. And, you know, we definitely see engagement fall off as the summer comes along, mm-hmm. just because people are out doing other things, doing family things in the sunshine. But so we have to stick to a schedule in that time of year. And it's pound out, you know, a recap episode on Sunday nights and maybe an interview every Tuesday. And we try to do two per week, but we don't force ourselves to the schedule. And that sounds lazy, but it's actually the opposite. It's we never want to do a podcast just to do it.
Right.
Right. And if, you know, if we have a bunch stored up and some are time sensitive, we may release one on a Thursday, one on a Friday. It might be three in 1 week. If it's like, hey, the Masters is next week, let's get ahead of our preview is going to go out Friday. You have all weekend to listen to it if you want, or if you can wait till Monday. And so it does vary. This time of year, we can see kind of engagement slow down a little bit. It's called the fall series right now. It's just not a lot of the star players are playing week to week. And quite honestly, people are kind of a little fatigued with professional golf at this point of the year. And we see it pick right back up again. Every January, like clockwork, it's like people are into it, ready to go. So we're kind of gearing up for, you know, getting back to that two times a week schedule starting in January. And but like I said, we don't hold ourselves to it because we don't owe it to anybody but ourselves, right? We don't have our sponsors don't say like, we need an episode every blah, blah, blah. You know, we're not a part of any podcast network that requires a specific schedule. Our audience has an expectation, like a schedule expectation. If we release a Masters recap podcast on Tuesday instead of Sunday night, we have lost out to about 100 other golf podcasts that have an immediate reaction show to it.
Right.
So there are a lot of Sunday nights that, you know, spend in the editing bay, and, you know, we, if events on the West Coast, the first few weeks, the Hawaii events end at midnight, that it, you know, that's the non-glamorous side of the job, but hey, we also get to talk about golf for a living. So yeah, I don't mind staying up till 2 a.m. on a Sunday night every now and then to make sure people have it for Monday morning commutes.
So Chris, will your super fans of the podcast ever get to like meet your team in person? Like, have you had events at events? So tell us about what that's been like.
That's been something that is we've been slow to wade into just because we want to make sure we do it right. But we held our first event, it's called the Summit, last August in at Common Ground in Denver, Colorado. We teamed up with the Colorado Golf Association to have an event that benefited the Solich Leadership and Caddy Program. I hope I'm saying that right. Basically, a kind of a fundraiser for something we really believe in golf. They have an amazing public golf facility called Common Ground there in Denver. And we held the event there, had, you know, hundreds of people come in for the peak party the night before, and then over 100 people play in the event the next day. And it was a very affordable event. It was about $400 to play 36 holes, and you got all kinds of swag that came with it. You know, it was funny. We were selling merchandise there, and, you know, somebody said something to me like, oh, $30 for a t-shirt. Like, wow, that's a lot of money. And I was like, well, I mean, I'm kind of realizing, wait, we didn't advertise this very well. Like, the money's not going to us. It's going to the leadership program. And that guy goes, oh, wow, I didn't know that. And he bought like three shirts.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was immediate, like, yeah. I think we over $10,000 was raised for this leadership program. And we did another event at Pinehurst that this past fall, and we're doing another several more next year, which we're going to roll out that schedule. But what was really cool, and to tie this back to Jacksonville, was our involvement. We've started to become involved with the Jacksonville Beach Golf Association here, and we had we've gotten to be pretty good friends with one of the guys that is the main leader of that. He came out to that event, and he wanted to see how the Colorado Golf Association is awesome. They do a great job with it. And he just wanted to come hang and learn from those guys and meet with those guys and talk and figure out how they can foster that environment that they've made there, which is an awesome golf course that costs $47 to play. How do you get that in Jacksonville, right? So when I just moved here last year in January, Jacksonville Beach Golf Club here, the local municipal course, was getting ready to close down for 10, 11 months because they're renovating the whole thing. And a guy named Harrison Minshew did the renovation here, and he did an awesome, awesome job. It was just a rundown golf course. The condition of it was not very good. The design was not very good. It was very difficult for amateur players and poor players to get over some of the water hazards and things like that. And it is so, so rare to see a city come together. Just municipalities are not designed to run golf courses. They don't understand how the game is played. There's so many bureaucratic hurdles that you have to get over in municipal golf. And it's so rare that it all comes together, and it did at Jacksonville Beach, and it's awesome. It's like $25 to go walk this golf course, and he got rid of a lot of the forced carries over water. So if you're Joe Schmo off the street and you're a 30 handicap and a poor golfer, you can go out there and not hit your ball in the water for the
most
part.
Still have fun.
Still have a lot of fun. Yeah. And it's engaging for higher skilled players. And so it's just this really, this amazing environment. And one of the cool things that came from that event was the learning about that caddy and leadership program. They're starting a similar program here in Jacksonville Beach. And they have their first caddy in the program. His name's Keanu. We met him a couple weeks ago. And so, again, going back to what we talked about in the very beginning of the mission statement of like inform and entertain our audience, what we don't have officially in there is also the word influence. And we want to be influential people in the game. And we're so freaking fortunate that we get to do all this that I don't want to say it is a way to sort of give back. And we're not proponents of the phrase grow the game, but we think there's a lot of things you can do to bring down the hurdles to keep people away from golf. And we're trying to bring that here to Jacksonville. Being involved here as official sponsor of the Jacksonville Beach Golf Association and helping them with awareness and, you know, using that place as kind of a home site for us to do cool things. We had Jim Furyk, who's local here and lives here in Jacksonville. He is the third highest earner in the history of the game of golf. He has made over $70 million on the course playing golf. And we had this dumb, really weird kind of parody golf show called Wild World of Golf. And he came and played Jacksonville Beach, which cost $25 to play. He played nine holes with us in like with a fake interviewer and a fake microphone and this whole parody broadcast. And he came out and did it. And one of the guys within the Jacksonville Beach Golf Association just sat around with us afterwards. Jim's telling stories. And they're just like, I never thought we would see Jim Furyk at Jacksonville Beach Golf Club. And that's kind of just a show. Like, if you build it, people will come. Like, right. And the city came together and figured out a way to get the funding. They are making money on the golf course now when it used to lose money every year. And it's so cool to see that come to a place that's 10 minutes down the road from us.
So let's talk about the value and the impact of the golf industry to Jacksonville in particular. Because, you know, here we are, Innovate Jax, and we want to, you know, our point is to try to connect the dots here with people who are doing remarkable things across the city. You're certainly one, and you're in this whole new vertical with it we've really not talked about, but you're so close to what's really meaningful to people, quality of life and opportunity and everything. What is that impact of golf to Jacksonville from your perspective?
Oh, I mean, that's the reason why I came down here. I mean, it's one thing. For me, I've never lived in the South. I've never lived somewhere where the best months to play golf are actually the winter, the fall, and the spring. And the summer is actually the worst time. But you can truly play golf 12 months a year here. Jacksonville is also the home. Ponte Vedra specifically is the home of the PGA Tour, as we mentioned. There's tons of professional golfers that live down here as well. So for us, we do a lot, try to do as much in-person content with professionals as we can. And moving to a hub, a golf hub like Jacksonville, was kind of a no-brainer. And we've gotten to play a lot of golf with some of the professionals. You learn to play with them. You learn more about the game from them, which translates to the content. And it's just, it's a good jumping off point too to, you know, a lot of golfers live in Florida. We're 4 hours to drive down to West Palm if we want to meet up with any of the golfers that live down there.
Sure.
Golfers that live in Tampa.
Lots in Orlando too,
Tons in Orlando. A lot in Atlanta, up the coast of Sea Island. I mean, it's just a not even specific to Jacksonville. It's a great jumping off point to get to a lot of places in golf. So it was kind of a no-brainer from that perspective. And honestly, a lot of people, you know, DJ and the guys down here get on me for promoting Jacksonville so much because they're like, hey, let's not ruin the secret here. Like, they call it the land of low-cost goods and services. It's a very affordable place to live.
Right.
I mean, this house here is a 3-bedroom house, and it's a block from the beach. And the rent is slightly more than I paid for a 1-bedroom in Amsterdam.
Right.
And like, it's just I would have thought living at the beach would have been way more expensive than that. And it's just, I've really, really enjoyed Jacksonville, especially rounding into this time of the year. If we had done this interview in the middle of summer, I might've been like, I'm okay on this place. But you know, this part of the year is really nice. You get to wear your long sleeves, but it's also, you know, you're not dealing with the snow.
Dealing with snow and no ice.
That is such a difference maker. It really, is. So,
for real.
And I thought it was going to have a bit more, you know, living at the beaches. I don't live in downtown. I live at the beaches, which is kind of a separate part of Jacksonville, of course. And I thought it was going to be more of a small town feel and more of like a running into the same people all the time. But I don't feel that. I really don't experience that. And it's not a place with snowbirds. You know, people live here year round. It's not Jupiter where I go down there. I went down there in the summer and it's just like restaurants are just closed. They're not even open yet. And they literally close down for the summer. And the population increases by about 1 million when you go into the winter. And I'm really glad to have that kind of, you know, this is a place people live, not a place people really vacation, but it's a place you live year round.
Right, right. So, you know, as far as where you see yourselves going, mm-hmm. you know, you are this, you know, this massive thing right now with your podcast. And how many Twitter followers do you have?
Somewhere over 180,000, I think, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That's no small shakes. Yeah. You know, and you've got these videos. Where do you host your videos?
They're on YouTube, our YouTube channel, No Laying Up.
Okay.
And we put those on Twitter when we can and on Instagram. And
you got a few followers on YouTube, I'm sure.
We're getting there. About 35,000 I guess 105,000 or so on Instagram, and then 35,000 on YouTube. It's kind of like, I've definitely dedicated the most time to Twitter, and the YouTube thing started maybe 2 years ago.
Right.
So we're still picking up steam on that.
Right.
We're lucky that we have this built-in audience now that we can send people to other mediums to help grow those mediums and stuff. And sometimes the audience is different on Twitter than it is on YouTube, but I'm sure there's some crossover there as well.
So where do you see this company growing?
You know, it's a question we get a lot, and it's not one that we really have a great answer for, in that we don't want... We want it to build, we want it to grow, but we don't want to stop doing what got us to be successful. And I think the podcast space has become very crowded in recent years, but we never want that to be a thing that we just kind of forget about and do. Because we've figured that out. Like, let's keep doing the same model on that. We want to keep innovating and evolving that. And we've been successful because we have evolved over the years. You know, the jokes we were making in 2014 are different than the jokes we make in 2019 and into the future. What that means for the future, we're still figuring that out. We'd love to kind of offload some of the editing and some of the grunt work that comes with that, which would require some hiring and require, you know, taking on some risk that, you know, we're at some point we're going to be willing to take on, but we have a model that's working for us now, and we're not really in the hurry to shake that up. We want to continue to do creative, new, fun ideas. We don't want to fall into a boring routine and kind of shut off our brains and just coast. But we don't know what those ideas are. We have some ideas. We're not ready to announce them yet. But 2020 content will look different than 2019 content. And I think the following years will look different as well. But, you know, we've had some interest from, you know, different large networks that want us to be a part of their network and have given us some offers. And we are totally fine being independent. We have no financial backing. We have funded this all ourselves. No investors, no debt. And it's a pretty nice way to live. And it's we answer to each other and to ourselves and not to anyone else except for the audience. And we like to keep it that way. I think the best way to continue to deliver for that audience is to eliminate as many stakeholders as possible.
Right, right. Keep the barriers,
yes.
You know, down, just like you said about
exactly.
The game of golf. You want to keep the barriers down too.
The second some investor comes in and says, hey, we need this many impressions for next month, that's when we know we've messed up.
Right.
So.
Right. All right. Well, Chris Solomon, this has been the most fun, I think, that we have had so far on Innovate Jax. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
It was great. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Furcura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Furcura.com. Thanks for listening.